I wish everyone a happy start to winter and a few days in advance. Painful for me to say that, it really is. But that's the reality of what the calendar tells us is upon us. Now, hockey players, they're known as the boys of winter, speaking of winter, right? And our sports dedication this week looks to those boys of winter and an infamous event that occurred right around this time of year back in the late 1970s. The primary infamous perpetrator today is a nationally recognized NHL analyst. Allow me to explain with the critical details. So it's the Boston Bruins versus the New York Rangers, two of the original six franchises going at it once again. Madison Square Garden, New York City was the setting, December 23rd, 1979, right before Christmas around this time of year. Let's just say the Christmas spirit didn't prevail during the events I'm about to describe. Back in the day with the NHL, remember, fighting was a typical event during a game. Many fans often went to hockey games in hopes of seeing melees of paired off combatants or entire teams in some instances going at it. And the Bruins and Rangers, you know, they weren't strangers to fighting. And the longstanding heated rivalry that only fueled the fire more each time they met. Now, it's one thing for a paying fan to go to the game in the hopes of watching a brawl on the ice. And then these days, you hear from all these leagues and pro teams about how they aim to create a fan-inclusive experience. I think that's the term that you often hear. Well, around this time, back in 1979 at Madison Square Garden, Rangers fans were treated to a spectacle that no one anticipated, and it took brawling and a fan-inclusive experience to new levels. The game itself played out over the three periods, and it was very physical. There were fights, roughing-type penalties filled the game, and both teams were committing various acts of aggression. Now, when the third period ended, the Bruins ended up on the winning end of the score. They won the game. And that's when things move from the official game to a form of, let's say, interactive entertainment. And that's when pandemonium struck. Bruins forward, Al Secord, he started things off with a sucker punch to a Rangers forward, Alf Nielsen, as the players started to head to the locker rooms when the game was over. And Secord said it was an eye for an eye because Nielsen sucker punched him earlier in the game. Now, as both teams got into a scrum after that sucker punch, a New York Rangers fan by the name of John Captain, so Johnny Captain, a fan of the Rangers in the stands, he reaches over the low-level glass, and it was lower, the glass was, than today's game and era. So he was able to reach over it, and he used a rolled-up program, and he hit Bruin Stan Jonathan in the head, apparently drawing blood. Now, I'm not sure how a rolled-up program would draw blood. Maybe there was, I don't know, something like a lead pipe inside the rolled-up program. Who knows? Oh, and then the fan also ripped the stick out of Jonathan's hands. He ripped his hockey stick and ran with his hockey stick into the stands. Here's how the Bruin player Jonathan recalled it. He just reached over the glass and whacked me with it. I put my stick up to protect myself, and he just took it. And I can't be hitting no fan with a stick, really, so I just let him take it. Now, old-time hockey and Bruins fans, they know the name Terry O'Reilly. He was a tough guy during an era of tough guys in hockey. So he racked up the most penalty minutes in franchise history with over 2,000 in his career. He saw what happened. He's on the ice. He sees what happens to his teammate, Jonathan. And he immediately stepped up to respond to an extreme because O'Reilly climbs over the glass, the low glass, to go after the fan, John Captain, who still had Jonathan's stick. And once the rest of the Bruins saw O'Reilly charge into the stands, they all followed suit. The entire team was now over the glass and into the stands of Madison Square Garden. So this fan, Captain, he gets run down by O'Reilly, but he gets free of him. But then another Bruin, teammate Mike Milbury, he chases after him and he caught him. And Milbury removes the shoe of Captain, gives him a whack with it, and then tosses the shoe onto the ice. And here is how the now famous national hockey analyst Milbury put it. I grabbed his shoe, took a little tug on it, and then sort of double pumped. I don't know if I hesitated for a minute because I thought I'd be vilified for the next 30 years, but I gave him a cuff across the leg, and then I did what I thought was probably the most egregious thing of all. I threw his shoe on the ice. The Rangers fans, you know, they were upset to say the least. Long after the Bruins left the stands, hundreds of Rangers fans rocked the Bruins team bus outside of the garden, and had to be dispersed by cops outside of MSG. Now, the fan captain and other fans that were involved in this melee in the stands who attacked and were attacked, frankly, they got it from both sides. They gave and they took. They ultimately had no charges filed against them, and they didn't file charges against the Bruins players. Just another hockey game, I guess. But O'Reilly and Milbury, they were suspended for multiple games by the league. All members of the Bruins roster were fined, except for one player, the goaltender, Jerry Cheevers, who's a great goaltender. And he wanted nothing to do with the incident from the beginning. And he jokingly said, "I was already on my second beer." Now, not long after this event, the league made the decision to raise the glass between the players and the fans. And I remember as a little kid seeing the highlights of this incident and just was completely shocked. Hockey for me at that moment became a spectator sport that had a more dangerous aura about it than even football. Check out the incident on YouTube to relive this episode's dedication and to see Mike Milbury going into the stands to commit the Great Shoe Incident. Let's make a starting connection for this episode, linking how police, New York City's finest, helped to restore order in a chaotic Madison Square Garden during that hockey game, to how officials in communist Cuba, of all places, were tasked with trying to restore power across the island nation. Just over a month ago, in late October, millions of Cubans went without electricity for days on end, and the government was unable to quickly restore nationwide power service after a massive blackout. And to make the timing even worse, a hurricane hit the eastern tip of the island right after the blackout. It's the last thing the Cuban economy, which has been on the verge of collapse, needed. Running water ceased to function, banks and ATMs shut down, basic goods and services couldn't be distributed. That's effectively what happens when a society loses access to energy. The prolonged blackout in a tropical climate such as Cuba's, that resulted in widespread spoilage of food because of the lack of air conditioning and refrigeration. Electric stoves, they're useless if there's no electricity. That makes the problem worse. So what is a Cuban to do when access to reliable energy ceases to exist? Residents of Havana resorted to cooking with coal or firewood out in the street. Traffic accidents, along with the serious injuries that result from them, they spiked because traffic lights didn't work. No one was able to go anywhere anyway in most instances because they couldn't get fuel for their vehicles or because public transportation also had to shut down. A Cuban who was interviewed for a newspaper story about the blackout said, "It's just like a war economy." And he ended up, by the way, losing power for days. The government ultimately declared a state of emergency. And here is what they did, what that meant. And tell me if any of this sounds familiar and gives you a flashback to pandemic emergency powers in the United States a few years back. So the government in Cuba halted all non-vital services. It ordered the closure of schools and universities. It shut down bars and nightclubs and all non-essential workplaces. Remember that term, non-essential work. Government workers were sent home, and the government mandated worker brigades to protect government facilities from being looted. Yeah, that's the type of nirvana in society that manifests if you allow vital energy infrastructure to erode. Cuba's grid, like everything else in its economy, it's heavily government regulated and state controlled. And it's another example of how government is less than optimal, inept, when it comes to building and operating complex and vital systems. Oh, in case you're interested, what or who did the Cuban government blame for the blackouts? United States sanctions. Some things never change. Now, many of you constant listeners, you might hear this story about Cuba's plight and think, well, that's not the United States and it could never happen here. Don't be so sure. And I can back that up by making a connection to our next dot, what New Mexico is doing when it comes to energy policy. The best descriptor might be a self-inflicted collapse of its economy bordering on suicide. That's because New Mexico seems hell-bent on copying California's energy and climate policies. Keep in mind that New Mexico, statewide, does share something in common with at least urban California, which is sky-high poverty rates. In fact, according to the Census Bureau, New Mexico has one of the nation's highest poverty rates. And for some crazy reason, those running the state think it would be a great idea to impose on New Mexico citizens the California energy playbook. The governor of New Mexico signed the Energy Transition Act, which requires that half of the state's electricity come from wind and solar by 2030, and that mandate goes to 100% by 2045. And the governor didn't stop there. Last year, she signed an executive order requiring all state vehicles be electric by 2035. That's government vehicles. But get this, fire trucks, police cars, snow plows, and emergency vehicles, they're exempt from the EV rule. And that should tell you all you need to know about how the reliability of EVs are viewed by those who want to mandate and impose them upon the masses. And right after the EV mandate, a bureaucratic board in New Mexico adopted California's auto rules for personal auto sales, which requires increasing the percentage of New Mexico's new car and light truck sales to be electric. 43% of those sales in 2027, 82% of those sales by 2032, and then, of course, the obligatory 100% of those sales by 2035. Electric vehicles, by the way, in New Mexico, that is a horrendously bad match. There's only about 10,000 EVs registered in the state currently. That's about 0.5% of the total registered vehicles in state. And, you know, much of the state, of course, is rural and not urban, meaning EVs with limited range and very few charging stations outside of, you know, say, Santa Fe or Albuquerque. That's going to be a losing proposition. In New Mexico's weather, it's also not conducive to EVs. Winter temperatures up north in the state could reach minus 30 degrees. While summer temps in the south can exceed 110, those types of conditions, they seriously erode battery range for EVs. And all this stands to bankrupt auto dealers in New Mexico. There was a dealer in Roswell who said this about the EV mandates. "Dealers like me will be forced to buy EVs I can't sell, and I won't be able to sell the vehicles my customers want to buy. No business can survive that." Unfortunately, that's well put. And he is right. Yet what everyone needs to understand is that might indeed be the desired outcome, bankrupting auto dealers or making the personal vehicle less affordable. That might be desired outcomes of EV mandates with these types of policies. And then early in 2024, the governor was at it again by signing legislation that imposed California's Clean Fuels Rule, which mandates a reduction in the carbon intensity of fossil fuels that are sold in the state. So this will apply to everything from gasoline to diesel to natural gas, along with electricity and utility bills, which means, just like in California, industries such as oil refineries in New Mexico, they're going to shut down or convert to more expensive alternatives to gasoline and diesel, which will impose a regressive form of a fuel tax on what is already one of the poorest states in the union. And for basically no benefit, because New Mexico as a state, it's a non-starter when it comes to global greenhouse gas emissions. It's a pimple on the proverbial elephant's you know what. But one of the truly legitimate and vibrant industries in the state is oil and gas production. In 2023, oil and gas contributed $4 billion in revenue to the state. And that's equivalent to about 40% of total state government spending. Yeah, indeed, these leftist policies that are being imposed upon New Mexico, they aim to bite the hand, or in this case, the industry, that feeds the government. And that is insane. What's more insane is while attacking the one vibrant industry in New Mexico that generates enough tax revenue to cover 40% of total state government spending, residents are going to end up paying additional prices and shouldering incremental pain. Electricity costs are going to skyrocket, just like they did in California. And as evidence, consider the largest electric utility in New Mexico now wants to raise customer rates by almost 30% on top of a rate increase that was imposed in early 2024. But those lobbying for these rules in New Mexico, you know, they've got the audacity to claim that those rules will not increase energy prices. And who or what is going to hold these individuals and entities that are purposely destroying New Mexico's economy and grid? Who's going to hold them to account? Until someone does, expect the insane push to economic ruin to continue in places like New Mexico when it comes to the climate alarmist movement and the left. Unfortunately, experts and bureaucrats and environmentalists promising a fantasy when pushing policies that deliver pain and misery, it's nothing new, nor is the lack of accountability for doing so. And we can discuss an example of such promises from the past that have proven to be lies in the environmental arena, with a connection to the dot of recycling. The recycling religion, much like the climate alarmist movement, it was decades in the making. It applied very similar ideology of many radical environmental policies, and the experts swore that recycling would make sense, it would be economic, it would improve the environmental health of everything from local communities to the planet. The next thing you know, every house has a recycling bin, and recycling becomes mandated across America. And citizens accepted it. They stopped thinking about it, and they paid all the additional municipal fees to duplicate the waste hauling supply chain, and they went on about their lives. But economics and chemistry, they didn't forget about it. And the economics and chemistry of recycling have exposed the reality that's quite different than what the experts had promised when imposing it across our communities. So when a garbage truck pulls up each week or every other week to your home and collects the contents of your recycle bin, very little of it might actually get recycled. To be specific, under 14% of waste plastic containers and packaging that goes into your recycling bins are sent to recycling facilities across America. And that was for 2018 data, and it's straight from the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA itself. And about 17% of plastic that you put in your recycle bins was incinerated, and almost 70% went to landfills. That's not what you were taught to believe, is it? And it's not much better for glass containers that are recycled. Only about 31% ends up being recycled. For aluminum, only a third are ultimately recycled. Now, these abysmal recycling rates are because of two things in the real world. As I said, chemistry and economics. The duo dictates that the vast majority of glass, aluminum, and plastic, they're never recycled and are either incinerated or landfilled. But we keep playing the game and incurring the additional cost of separating trash as if all of it was recycled. It's a kabuki theater that puts a happy face and a feel-good veneer to hide a very different reality. And one of the big changes that drove down recycling rates of those materials is that the biggest taker of our recycled trash, China, stopped taking most foreign waste back in 2018. Once China stopped taking everyone else's trash, the flawed economics and the unassailable chemistry of the situation exposed the truth about recycling. Oh, and virgin plastic, it's cheaper and better than recycled plastic. Now, what's sort of frustrating about the recycling reality is that now that it's exposed, all the experts advise us to do a better job of sorting our trash. So the economics and the chemistry of recycling, it's our fault, and that the consumer needs to further change his or her behavior. Perhaps instead, we should be calling for an accounting of accountability, so to speak, that aims to assess the root causes of how, while we've been told one thing, and been forced to incur additional costs tied to recycling, all along, the reality was telling us something quite different. I guess our prior connections and dots, they're hitting upon a theme for this episode 187, that of accountability when it comes to policymakers and politicians and bureaucrats when they impose rules and regulations upon citizens, which leads to a connection to a troubling dot, how those government workers are working. And how much they're working. Taxpayers and private sector workers may be less than pleased to know the truth. Remote work and working from home have become, thankfully, artifacts of draconian pandemic policies. But when it comes to government workers, those things have become permanent perks, especially for federal government workers. When you drive past a federal government building, whether it's in Washington, D.C. or elsewhere, chances are wide portions of that office are vacant, because the federal bureaucracy is still working from home as we enter 2025. Two senators, one Republican and one Democrat, they're calling for an ultimatum to get government workers back into the office. They proposed a statute that would require each federal agency to lay out its work from home policy and count how many of their employees come into the office. And that would give Congress the information it needs to hold the laggards accountable. It was approved in a congressional committee in September of this year, which is good news. Now, what we know in lieu of the more complete data that would maybe be demanded from that type of a statute if it ever gets to Congress for a vote, is that the federal government workforce is in an embarrassing state. Not one of the 24 largest federal agencies used even half of its office space during a three-month period in 2023, and that's according to the Office of Personnel Management. The Social Security Administration, which oversees a multi-trillion-dollar trust fund that is on the verge of collapse, it saw only 7% of its space occupied by workers. And there is a large degree of taxpayer fraud that is ensuing along with federal government remote work. At the Commerce Department, almost a quarter of sampled employees continued to claim residency in Washington, D.C. or other pricey cities after moving to less expensive places. And doing so allowed the workers to keep their higher pay levels that are indexed to cost of living locations. So while working remote, remind you, they did this. And then there's the various cases of federal employees not working at all while they're supposed to be working. The Biden administration seemed to do everything it could to halt attempts to gain data and understanding of the scale of this federal worker morass. But that might change with a change in administration. We'll see. And once you have the data on vacancies for these different federal agencies, there's already a law on the books that mandates executive branch agencies create and carry out plans to reduce unused space. It's known as the Federal Property Management Reform Act. So we just need to know the data that will sum up the current state of the federal workforce, and then it would be input to the execution of an already existing law. Now, none of this is cheap for taxpayers. Federal office space requires $7 billion a year to hold and maintain. And if it's not being used, American taxpayers stand to benefit from the savings. It's about that time, I'm afraid. So let's wind down episode 187. Looking back, what did we discuss this episode? We had at first the outlaw acts that were occurring at a hockey game. We talked a little New Mexico, a bit of discussion on automobiles, and we covered the work habits of federal government agencies. Let's conclude this episode by making a connection to a final dot that ties all those things together. More specifically, the town of El Paso, which has several federal government agencies within its city environs, automobiles, as in NASCAR racing, and an outlaw song that makes mention of New Mexico in its lyrics. What am I talking about? Well, if you've been listening for the past year or so of the Far Middle, and I hope that you have, you know I've developed a taste and interest in outlaw country recently. And one of the greatest singles in the history of outlaw country, or perhaps more appropriately labeled Western music in this case, it comes from the artist Marty Robbins and his masterpiece El Paso. It was released in 1959, and it was a Grammy winner. The song is special for a couple of reasons. First, its lyrics lay out a very telling and colorful story. You feel like you're part of it when listening to the song. Second, the song itself doesn't have a chorus, but as a listener, you never seem to miss it. And I suppose you would call this song a ballad about the classic themes of love mixed with looming danger. And the subject of the song almost seems to have a death wish, but one in which he's willing to sacrifice it all in the name of something that truly matters to him. In this case, a woman by the name of Felina. And I must warn you, the song has a sad ending. It is indeed an awesome song. And you can tell that Marty Robbins was able to draw upon the stories he heard from his grandfather as a kid. His grandfather was Robert Heckel, who was a Confederate soldier in the Civil War and then served under General Custer after the war, and he lived to tell about it. Bob Dylan called the song El Paso complex yet simple. The Grateful Dead would cover it for many years in their concerts. And if you're a fan of the series Breaking Bad, like I am, you may know the song El Paso was featured in the series finale. Oh, and the connection to vehicles and NASCAR that I mentioned with this song? Well, Marty Robbins also was a successful NASCAR racer after he hit it big in the music industry. In 1972, at the Winston 500, Robbins stunned the competition. He was turning laps that were way faster than his qualifying time. So after the race, he did so well that NASCAR wanted to bestow the Rookie of the Race Award on Robbins, but he wouldn't accept it. So why wouldn't he accept it? Well, it turns out that he had cheated. He basically took off the NASCAR mandated restrictions from his carburetor, and he admitted he did it because he just wanted to see what it was like to run up front for once. That's what he said. Well, Marty should have already known what it was like to run up front when he released El Paso years prior to that NASCAR race. We're going to reestablish our link in a week. Until then, always stay connected to that Far Middle.